Awesome. All right. Well, thank you guys for being here today. So for those of you who don't know me, my name is Ben, and I'm currently a Miller Fellow working with Oskar Halicek at UC Berkeley. So for my talk today, I want to switch gears a little bit from what we've been talking about for the past several talks and tell you about a purely theoretical project I've been working on and off over the past couple months, which I thought was sort of particularly appropriate for this program. The talk is sort of a work in progress, so please feel free to interrupt with questions at any point if something's unclear. Okay, so to motivate the project, I want to start by looking at some experimental data. So on Friday, Michael Desai already presented these results from our sequencing study of Rich Lenski's long-term evolution experiment in E. coli. And so for those of you who weren't here on Friday, each one of these lines here represents a different de novo mutation that we detected at some point during the experiment. And we can trace the frequency of these mutations within this one particular replicate population, ERA minus 6, as a function of time across this 60,000 generation sampling period. So one of the most interesting things I think we were able to see with this data was the sort of spontaneous emergence of long-term quasi-stable coexistence in many of the replicate populations. And so you can see that here in that many of these mutations appear to sort of pile up or cluster into these two intermediate frequency clades that coexist with each other for roughly 40,000 generations here. Once these clades arise, we see that population-wide fixations basically cease, but we continue to have these sort of relatively rapid accumulation of mutations within one clade or another. So looking across the different replicate populations in Rich's experiment, we see this sort of thing in 9 out of the 12 replicate populations. We don't currently know what the exact mechanism of the frequency dependence is in many of these, but our best guess is that it's probably related to the same glucose acetate crossfeeding interaction that was previously shown to have evolved spontaneously in this ERA minus 2 population, in which other people have investigated a lot in E. coli. So I think the interesting thing from this new data is that on these really longer timescales here, we see that the frequency-dependent interactions aren't necessarily stable on longer timescales. Instead, the relative frequencies of these clades can shift by as much as tenfold at various points during the experiment, presumably driven by mutations that accumulate either in sort of one background or the other. So, this is just a hypothesis, of course. To check it for sure, we'd actually have to go in and sort of reconstruct each mutation on the background in which it arose and do competition experiments. But we think it's supported by the fact that the timing and magnitude of these fluctuations in the clade frequencies varies pretty widely from population to population, consistent with them being caused by random accumulation of mutations. There's also one particular example where people have gone in and actually done some of these reconstructions. And this is work by Jessica Plokane and collaborators from Dom Schneider's group, where they actually showed that they could recapitulate the frequency-dependent interaction in this ERA minus 2 population by doing a genetic reconstruction, and that the sort of differences between the equilibrium frequencies of these two reconstructions can be ascribed to the mutational differences between them. Right, so at least in one case, we know some mutations that can lead to shifts in the equilibrium frequency, similar to what we think we observe in the data. Okay, so of course, this stuff isn't really just specific to Rich's experiment of E. coli growing in serial dilution. Similar sorts of frequency-dependent interactions have been seen in a lot of different experimental settings, so including E. coli grown in starvation conditions, yeast adapting to stick to the walls of these 96-well plates in some of the experiments from Michael Desai's lab, this classic example of the wrinkly spreader phenotype in Pseudomonas evolving to colonize the sort of air-liquid boundary in test tubes. And I think one of my favorite examples from Von Cooper's lab, where they tried to adapt Burkholderia to grow to sort of periodically stick to the plastic ball and then dissociate from it when it's put into a new test tube over and over again every day for 1,000 generations. So in this particular experiment, they saw that they could rapidly and reproducibly evolve three different sort of stable ecotypes, which have different colony morphologies. But I think more interestingly, when they went in to actually sequence these populations, they found that indeed, many of them keep acquiring mutations, as we saw in the Lenski example from before. But in this case, we also have sort of periodic recolonization of some of the niches by additional mutations that arise sort of from the larger ecotype into one of these smaller ones. So if you looked at the genealogy of this population, it would sort of look nothing like the three colors here. Instead, you would see a very short genealogy owing to these recolonization events. Okay. And of course, there's many other examples which I haven't had time to talk about here. So this isn't just a problem for experimental evolution either. As we all know, many populations of microbes in the wild have to grow in the context of larger microbial communities. For example, here's some data I plotted for the gut microbiome, which I'll discuss in a little more detail in my talk next week. So in this particular example, the ecology isn't just a competition between two or three different types of strains, but anywhere between 10 or 100, depending on how you count things. So one of the things that I'm really excited about these kind of systems is because, you know, we usually measure these species abundances through DNA sequencing these days. So in principle, we also should get a little bit of information about how these different coexisting strains are related to each other, in addition just to their overall abundances. Okay, so although these sorts of genealogical observables aren't really often included in traditional ecological models, I think it suggests that if we can figure out some way of understanding how these genealogical and ecological processes interact, we might be able to start placing some much stronger constraints on the kinds of models that are consistent with the data we observe both in these experimental populations and also in some of these more interesting populations in the wild. So that's sort of the goal here. Okay, so for today's talk, I just want to tell you about one particular model which I think is potentially quite useful for addressing these sorts of questions. This model is going to lie somewhere along this continuum between modeling a specific experiment in all of its gory details and a sort of more abstract population genetic approach where you assume that the sort of different species and admixture rates and demographies are all sort of fixed externally. It's supposed to be sort of a rough facsimile of some of these microbial evolution experiments, but trying to strip away as much detail as possible to see if we can actually make some analytical progress. Okay, so in particular, I want you to imagine a bunch of individuals growing in some sort of well-mixed chemostat-like environment, which is supplied by P different completely substitutable resources at some fixed external flux and you know, outflux at some other rate delta. So you can think of these different resources as sort of different carbon sources, glucose, acetate. Okay, so each of the individuals in this environment gets to choose how much of its energy budget or however you want to say it, they devote towards metabolizing resources of these different types. And we assume that this resource strategy is sort of fixed genetically. So there's no regulation here. You're born with a specific strategy of, you know, this guy imports all green molecules, this guy imports 2/3 red and 1/3 blue. And so on. So this is just a particularly simple example of a broad and well-studied class of consumer resource models from ecology, which model sort of jointly the abundances of each of these different strains and the concentrations of the different resource in the chemostat. And for those of you who were here during Ned Wingreen's talk a couple weeks ago, I'm talking about essentially the same model that he described in his work as well. Okay, so after some massaging, which I'll sort of leave out of this talk, you can often eliminate trying to track the concentrations of the resources individually and write down sort of a coarse-grained, effective model for the frequencies of the individual strains. So I'll explain what these terms are here, but just so you guys can look at them throughout the rest of the talk, I also wrote them on the board. Okay. So F sub mu here is going to index the relative frequency of each one of the strains in this well-mixed chemostat. And we can break down the infinitesimal change in this quantity into two contributions, as we normally do in population genetics, a deterministic contribution due to natural selection and a stochastic component due to genetic drift. So the drift term is going to be sort of inversely proportional to the total population size in this system, which you can show in this case ends up being related to sort of the total influx of nutrients divided by the total outflux rate. The selection term ends up being a sum over these different kinds of resources that each strain could use. And the sum is going to be weighted by this term alpha mu I, which is going to tell you the fraction of the strain mu's energy budget that it devotes towards metabolizing resources from resource I. These things are defined such that they're normalized to one for every choice of mu. So because of this normalization, we also haven't really accounted for the overall energy budget of each strain. And so I'm going to represent this by this additional parameter X sub mu, which is going to sort of represent in some sense the sort of general overall fitness of strain mu. So you can think of it sort of like growth rate in this context. The competition is mediated by this additional parameter x bar I, which behaves in some sense like a resource-specific mean fitness. And the definition is written down here. You can see that it depends both on sort of how much resources each one of the strains currently present in the ecosystem is currently using, and this parameter beta sub I, which defines the fraction of the nutrients supplied by each resource I. So again, these things are defined such that the betas are normalized and sum to one.
Maybe you mentioned it, I missed it, but what's the square root term in the consumer resource model?
This term here?
In the
this here. So this is adding sort of demographic fluctuations due to a finite population in the chemostat. So often in the ecology literature, this sort of thing's absent. But since we're going to be talking about individual mutations, the number of fluctuations are going to become quite important.
CI, lambda I.
Yeah, exactly. So this is sort of how you would write things down sort of at the microscopic level if you wanted to track these different resources. So the CI represents the concentration of resource I in the chemostat. The lambda I sort of represents, the lambda I's are basically a Lagrange multiplier which links the growth of an individual strain to the sort of outflux of a given resource. This is kind of the most general model you can write down of these things that will lead to the specific form that I showed down here. Right, so we assume that basically the growth is linear in the uptake of each of these resources, and that each of these resources is converted into biomass at some fixed rate. And then to get these dynamics down here, you basically have to assume that the bacteria grow so fast that they're essentially always using all of the sort of excess resources at any one time. And so,
just as a peasant, I would have written CI instead of lambda I.
You would have written CI instead of
lambda I. So why isn't the growth proportional to abundance of that resource?
Exactly. So in this case, that lets you enforce that constraint. It doesn't exactly have to be that way in all possible models. This is just one way of writing it down that lets you sort of derive it in the most general case.
Is it okay for me to think of the sort of simplest form of this?
Yes. Exactly. So you can implement these sort of general things just with really simple Monod uptake rates, sort of like net represented. Okay. If you do it that way, you might start to argue, well, maybe something's not Monod or blah, blah, blah. But it's a little more general than that.
Okay.
Yeah.
And And again, so how does X depend on C? So was there some...
Yeah, exactly. So if you want to...
Equation that has to be written down somewhere?
So if you want to think about X in alpha... So originally we parameterized them with these R's, which is just the raw rate of uptake of different resources. And so you can normalize these R's to get the alphas, right? What fraction of your uptake rate is devoted to different resources.
I'm just looking for an additional differential equation, right? We had some dynamics of resources.
Yeah.
C.
Yeah.
And where is it now?
Exactly. So to go from here to here, you basically have to make the assumption that the bacteria grow relatively fast relative to how the resource changes, and that allows you to eliminate. Yeah. So that's not always possible. If you start to venture outside this linear regime, you can have feedbacks and things like that. But we're just going to focus on the simplest case. Yeah.
I was just wondering about the square root. Because that equation there is a deterministic equation, so it doesn't have any...
Sorry, the eta here is supposed to represent a Brownian noise term. So the square root just tells you that it's sort of number fluctuations, just Poisson sampling due to outflow.
So this is basically a stochastic differential equation.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah, sorry, I should have pointed that out. Yeah, so this nu here is a stochastic term here, and it ends up being included in this coarse grain model as well. And so in the absence of any other selective forces, you also expect these relative frequencies to drift relative to each other. Over some time scale specified by the population size. Yeah, Wolfram.
Could you spell out what you mean by fraction for alpha I and beta I again, maybe?
Yeah, exactly. So the raw parameters in the model are like just the raw flux of resources into the model. But it turns out in going from this sort of microscopic dynamics to this effective model, the only thing that really matters is sort of the fractional contribution of each of these resources. So the total amount sets the total population size, and so then you can divide out by the total S, if you will, and what's left then are the betas. So it's like S1 divided by the sum of all the S's, right? And likewise for the alphas. So the overall R tells you how fast you grow sort of in absolute terms. And you can separate that out into a normalized version, which are the alphas, and this X, which tells you sort of how big the average of the total R is, summed across three sources. Yeah. Okay. So for relatively small fit, when fitnesses are small compared to one, which is the assumption we often make in population genetics, you can expand this exponential term here in the selection term and show that this model gives you back sort of relatively basic Locke-Volterra form for each, you know, for each one of these resources. And so in the case of a single resource, you see that this reduces back to the familiar logistic growth that we're used to in the Wright-Fisher model. So in some sense, you can think of this model as maybe the simplest possible generalization of the Wright-Fisher model from population genetics to account for sort of growth on a finite number of resources. Okay, so although the ecology ends up being a little more complicated than the classic Wright-Fisher model and logistic growth, it's still relatively easy from an ecologist's perspective. So in particular, you can show that the deterministic part of these dynamics end up having a Lyapunov function, which means that at long times, the system has a unique, stable global optimum that all the frequencies have to go to, regardless of their initial conditions. It depends only on the set of strategies that are present at the beginning, right? And you can often solve for these equilibrium frequencies using techniques from constrained optimization. So from an ecological perspective, these things are pretty simple. They don't have any of the sort of exotic, chaotic fixed points that you might see in other sorts of ecological models, or even more general Locke-Volterra models. So the reason we picked this particularly simple ecology is that we're now about to make things a lot more complicated by bolting on evolution and inheritable mutations on top. So for the purposes of this talk, I want you to think about two broad classes of mutations that we're going to allow these individuals to get. So the first type I'm going to call strategy mutations. And these are going to be mutations which alter this resource strategy alpha for a given individual while leaving these sort of overall fitness unchanged. So this is sort of the classic way that you would often try to marry ecology and evolution on top of each other. How do these ecological strategies sort of tune themselves over longer time scales? So sort of the new, really new ingredient here is that I also want to think about just a second class of mutations, which I'll call general fitness mutations, which are going to increment the overall fitness of the organism, but otherwise leave its resource strategy unchanged. Right, so this class of mutations is sort of motivated by a lot of the data we've been getting from these microbial evolution experiments, and it's supposed to model adaptation to a large number of other loci throughout the genome, which may only be tangentially related to the specific resource phenotypes that you see in any given experiment. Yeah.
In the formulation of R for the X mu, or the R X I's, what kind of mutation would that be? Like, I mean, the beta I's are not under mutational control.
Yeah, so the beta I's are fixed by the experimenter. They're the same for all time. What can change are the resource strategies of the given strain.
That's the strategy mutation.
And their relative fitness can also change with these general fitness mutations. So imagine you have just some function in this particular experiment that's not needed. And so you could increase your fitness by knocking out that gene. Right? And so in things like the Lenski lines, we think that actually most of the mutations we see are of that type. You know, even though we have ecology, we think that the mutations that specifically refer to these ecological phenotypes are probably a minority of all the mutations we see. And so this is just an attempt to actually try
to. So there, mutants probably want to be as high as possible.
Sorry, what wants to be as high as possible? Fitness.
The mutations that S, positive S will be selected for.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So their selection pressure is simple, I would guess.
Yes, yeah. The selection pressure is simple, but as we will see, they will have very big effects on the kinds of dynamics that we can see. Yeah, exactly. So you know, these kind of things seem like such a small addition to this model. They're really boring, they're just universally beneficial, they should just get incorporated and go away. But actually, it turns out that that sort of rate and spectrum of these general fitness mutations can have a big effect.
So everything else being equal, two different S's, the higher S will win.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. Exactly. So these general fitness mutations can actually have a really big impact on the kinds of dynamics that you see in this model. So So what I've shown you here are just some individual based simulations, which are designed to look a little bit like the data from the Lenski lines that I showed you earlier. It's simulations of four different sets of parameters. Each one of these lines here is the allele frequency of a specific mutation. I've colored the red ones are strategy mutations, and the blue ones are these general fitness mutations. And what I've done here is I've chosen the exact same environment, two resources, with the exact same distribution of strategy mutations available to the individuals, but different amounts and different sizes of general fitness mutations, right? So exactly the same ecological opportunities, but different amounts of fitness evolution. And you can see that you just get this huge, sort of huge range of different behaviors. It changes both the sorts of ecological structure that you see in this model and the kinds of evolutionary dynamics you see if you sort of looked over time, as well as the sort of genealogical structure you would see if you sort of simulated, you know, drawing a sample of individuals from the end and drawing a genealogy. Right, so the range of behaviors varies from this top thing where there are no general fitness mutations and you just relatively quickly establish a stable coexistence between two types, which we'll get into in a second. In the second panel, we see that in the presence of these general fitness mutations, you still sort of get, on average, steady coexistence between two types. But individual lineages are often only alive for a finite period of time before they're sort of outcompeted. And so you have these sort of punctuated bursts of fixation events and coexistence, you know, roughly similar to what we saw in the Lenski lines. If you add even more fitness mutations, but maybe tune down their fitness effects, you end up going back to something that looks a little more stable here. And finally, for a lot of really strong general fitness mutations, the effects of selection on just sort of being better at growing in the overall environment are enough to completely wipe out the stable coexistence that would have definitely been around had it had a chance to arise. Okay, so the general question I want to deal with in this talk here is, you know, what are the relevant parameters or knobs, if you will, that allow us to transition between these different behaviors? Right? We have this really simple model, and somehow by just tuning some of these really dumb parameters, we can get very different results. Or to think about it differently, if I just showed you a picture of one of these simulations, you know, what could you tell me about the parameters that I actually chose to run the simulations with? So that's going to be the goal. That's going to be the goal of the talk. Okay, so to understand this question, it's helpful to just go back to the simplest possible case you can think of. And that's going to be two resources in this environment and no general fitness differences at all, right? So this actually is sort of completely well described by these classic consumer resource models and maybe some intuition from adaptive dynamics, if you're familiar with that literature. Okay, so the scenario I want you to think about is that the population is initially colonized just by a single resident wild-type strain, which is going to have some strategy, alpha-1. And it's worth mentioning here that in the case of two resources, you know, we have an alpha for growing on resource 1 and an alpha for growing on resource 2. They normalize to 1, so actually there's only one of those numbers you have to keep track of. So that's going to be the one I keep track of here. Similarly, with the resource supply, it's just sort of one fixed number. The other one is just the 1 minus that. So we can write everything on sort of a real line here where this dashed line represents the supply that's fixed by the environment of you know, resource 1, for instance. And the strategies of the different individuals are going to be denoted by dots on this continuum. Okay, so you start with a population that's sort of fixed for one wild-type strain, and then we imagine that a new mutation occurs which changes the resource strategy of the individual to some different value, alpha 2. Okay. Now we want to imagine what happens to this particular individual. So assuming these mutations occur so infrequently, the mutation rates are sufficiently low that they occur one by one, we can model the size of this new mutant lineage with a relatively simple branching process familiar from population genetics, which takes into account the, again, deterministic action of natural selection and just number fluctuations due to genetic drift when the mutant is at low frequency. Okay. So it's exactly the same form as you might imagine, just for a sort of regular mutation population genetics. It ends up being crucially dependent on this term in braces here, which I'll call, probably refer to as the invasion fitness, which depends both on the resource strategy of the new mutant and the resource-specific average fitnesses that are currently present in the population. So for a single resident, a population with a single resident, these resource-specific mean fitnesses are really simple. It's just the log It's just the log of the resources supplied by the environment divided by the resources that are utilized by the resident strain. So you can, for the case of a two-resource environment where you just have these two numbers, you can sort of work out this sum, and it ends up being proportional to the difference in the resource strategy of the mutant relative to the resident, multiplied by this term, which tells you about the mean fitness in each of these two resources. So plugging in this formula for the resource usage for a single resident, you can derive a relatively simple formula for the invasion fitness of this new mutant. Right? So the invasion fitness is going to be positive if this new mutant resource strategy is in the direction of the environmentally supplied flux relative to its ancestor. Right? So in this case, this would be a positive invasion fitness mutation. It would also be positive if it landed over here, but it would be negative if it landed over here. Right? Just sort of working out the signs of this equation here. So is that clear? Okay. So assuming this invasion fitness is positive, with probability proportional to the invasion fitness, the mutation is going to establish, survive, grow large enough that it survives drift, and then it's going to start to deterministically spread through the population. So at this point, one of two things can happen. Right, so either the mutation can completely take over, in which case we'll call this selective sweep, or it could also be stabilized at some intermediate frequency due to frequency-dependent selection. So what distinguishes between these two scenarios, you can sort of work out by looking at reciprocal invasion fitnesses in this case, is that you'll basically always get a selective sweep if the mutant is closer to the environmentally supplied resource than the ancestor, and you'll get stable coexistence if the mutant manages to leapfrog the environmentally supplied resource vector such that the environment sits in between the two strains that are currently coexisting. So in this case, you can work out the equilibrium frequencies of these two strains in this situation, and the relative frequencies of the two strains end up being proportional to the distance each one is from the environmentally supplied resource. The closer you are to the environmentally supplied values, the bigger fraction of the population you're going to be. And given these equilibrium frequencies, you can then go show that sort of average environment-specific fitnesses for the two resources end up being zero, right? So there's no more selection. So you can also interpret these things a different way in that they mean that the population average uptake rate ends up being exactly pinned to the environmental supply rate. And so I think this gives a pretty simple interpretation for what this ecology is trying to do here, which is that there's some selection overall for the population uptake rate to match the environmental supply. So in this case, the best way the population can match the environmental supply is if the mutant totally takes over. In this case, you can actually do better than either mutant winning just by averaging them together at some frequency. So this will get back to some earlier questions. Of course, in a finite population, this thing won't be at some fixed value. It'll actually fluctuate a little bit due to number fluctuations. They'll undergo some characteristic displacement of order delta f. And in these sorts of models, you can work this out relatively easily. For large populations, it ends up being proportional to 1 over the square root of the population size times the typical difference between these two resource uptake strategies. So in large populations, these sorts of fluctuations are relatively negligible, and we're going to basically neglect them for the rest of the talk. But the threshold of the population required for this to work ends up getting bigger and bigger when you're considering strategies that are closer and closer together. So two guys that are really close to the environmental supply rate will undergo these sort of dramatic fluctuations competing with each other, whereas two complete specialists will undergo no fluctuations at all. Right? And so we're gonna end up seeing this sort of characteristic parameter alpha 2 minus alpha 1 pop up a lot in the analysis that follows in controlling some of the key behavior. Okay, so at this point, these little fluctuations are going to induce also some small fluctuations in the average fitnesses. And this is going to lead to sort of momentary selection pressures at any given time to sort of specialize on the resource that's less well utilized. But you can actually work out that these selection pressures end up being relatively small of order 1 over n, and they're averaged out very quickly relative to the n generations required for this mutation to fix. So on these longer sorts of timescales, once the ecosystem has evolved to sort of optimally utilize the resources, there's some marginal stability against additional mutations. They can invade by drift, but they're not either beneficial on average or deleterious on average. And Ned talked a lot about sort of the consequences of this observation in his talk a couple weeks ago, too. All right, so that's the simplest possible case that we can understand in the absence of these general fitness mutations. So how does general fitness alter this behavior? So we now imagine, let's just start with a system. It's already established one of these coexisting ecosystems. And now let's imagine a single general fitness mutation of some beneficial fitness effect S arising on the background of just one of these two strains. So you can work out relatively easily in this model that the invasion fitness of such a mutation has to be exactly equal to S, right? So exactly the same as it was sort of in the absence of any of this ecology stuff. And as Michael mentioned earlier, this means that with probability S, it's just universally beneficial for this mutation to start to sweep through its parent clade, right? The real question comes, okay, now that it's starting to take over, what is it actually going to do to the ecosystem, right? So two things, again, can happen. So if the fitness effect is sufficiently strong, it can sort of totally obliterate this ecological interaction which evolved and, again, lead to a complete sweep in the population. In this simple scenario, you can work out how big this fitness effect has to be to do this. And so you can write down a relatively simple expression, which you can see, again, depends most crucially on the relative difference between the resource strategies of these two competing strains and their deviation from the environmental supply.
The resource strategy is the same between the strains.
Sorry, there's two strains with two resource strategies, and now there's a third strain which has the same alpha 2 as this one, but different from this one.
But I thought I don't understand.
So before we were just looking at two strains, right?
But isn't at the end of this process, you just have one strain which uses the resource according to alpha 1 and alpha 2? Is that not what's happening?
Sorry, in this process or the one on the next slide?
Right. So
in this process, you now have two strains here. One of them uses it according to alpha 2. One of it uses it according to alpha 1. And they span the environmental supply so that they coexist at this intermediate value. Right, so this is specialization to grow on resource one, and this is specialization to grow on resource one, and specialization on resource two, however you want to order them. Okay, so this is the case where you just have two strains and no general fitness differences. So now I want to think about the next most complicated thing. So you already have these two strains coexisting with each other, and now I want to think about a third strain which is created by a mutation on the background of one of these two resource strategies. Does that make sense, or am I still being confusing?
It probably does, except I'm confused. Because, yeah. I mean, over here, the alphas have two indices.
Yeah, exactly. That's I was kind of worried about this. So the idea here is that in a two-resource environment, these two things have to sum to one, and so we can basically forget about the second index. So,
I see.
Right, so when I write alpha 1, it actually means alpha of strain 1 on resource 1.
Oh, okay.
Right, that's the sort of sleight of hand I've done here.
And yeah. Then alpha of strain 1 on resource 2, which is be 1 minus alpha 1.
Precisely, yeah. So you get all those for free, yeah. Yeah. And likewise for the beta as well. So, beta, the thing I'm going to write down as beta is actually beta 1. Right, so in this two resource case, you can actually eliminate a lot of your variables just by thinking about this one parameter.
So, but then, I mean, if you do adaptive dynamics of this alpha trait, you go to beta, and then the whole population is monomorphic for beta.
Exactly. Yeah. So traditionally in adaptive dynamics, So traditionally in adaptive dynamics, you imagine changes that are very small. Right. So. Basically, you're almost always in this case where you're moving a little bit closer to beta. Eventually, you get to beta and you're monomorphic, and then maybe it's unstable, so you can split. So in this case, I sort of want to explicitly think about mutations that might be big hops, sort of, again, motivated by these evolution experiments. So you could get a hop totally over beta and now stably coexist.
Right. But that's only stable ecological coexistence.
Exactly.
Because if you have evolution in those two,
yes.
Strains, they go both of them back to beta.
Well, we'll get into that. Yeah, it's a little more complicated with fitness mutations,
okay.
But that's exactly where I want to go.
You assume stable, so you have two strains that ecologically coexist, not necessarily evolution.
Yes. When I say stable, I almost always mean ecology, and then we're going to think about how evolution fusses that up. Okay, so again, yeah, we have these two ecologically stable strains that are coexisting, and now we have a mutation that arises in one of them. If it's strong enough, it can be evolutionarily unstable and get rid of the ecology, and we can work out what how big of a mutation you need in order to do that. And so basically what you find by working this out is that when the resource strategies are really close to each other, you actually only need a very small fitness effect mutation to totally obliterate the ecology that you see. Whereas for mutations that are complete specialists on one or the other, you'll of course never outcompete a specialist by a specialist of another type. So it all sort of makes sense from the on an intuitive level. Okay, so this is one possibility, a complete sweep. But of course, there's also a second possibility, which is that the mutation isn't strong enough to totally obliterate the ecology, in which case it sweeps through its parent clade, but not through the whole population, and possibly leads to a change in the equilibrium frequency of the two clades relative to each other. Right? So this is supposed to be an analogy to this these sorts of reconstruction experiments by Jessica Kulkane and collaborators, where they show that, again, these mutations were enough to shift the relative frequencies of these two competing clades. So in this model, it's you know, simple enough to actually work out what this shift in equilibrium frequency is supposed to be as a function of the fitness difference between them. The expressions you get are sort of a little bit complicated in the general case, but when the strains are relatively close in strategy to each other, which is the only case in which it ever really matters, you can write down a simpler form for how these two things behave. And you can see that the shift in the frequency, shift in equilibrium frequency of these two strains ends up being linearly proportional to the fitness difference between them, with some constant of proportionality, which you can sort of interpret as some characteristic fitness scale, X star, which tells you how big the fitness differences have to be before you can start shifting the relative frequencies of these two strains. Okay, so this case I'll probably refer to as a partial sweep sometimes. All right, so as time goes on, of course, then additional mutations will accumulate in one background or the other. And so you sort of enter into this sort of fitness race between these two competing clades, where their relative frequencies sort of fluctuate on longer evolutionary timescales. And this is supposed to be the sort of model analogy of these sort of clade dynamics that we saw in Alinsky lines. Okay, and the limit that individual shifts in frequency are small, or that the fitness effects S are small compared to this characteristic scale S star, you can model this sort of fitness race between the two clades with a relatively simple effective diffusion model. Again, this is assuming sort of weak selection or weak mutation, strong selection dynamics here. But the sort of diffusion constant in this diffusion model ends up being the sort of variability in when each of the two clades acquire mutations. And in this case, there ends up being a net bias as well, because a clade that makes up a bigger fraction of the population is actually going to be more likely proportionally to produce the next mutation. So this is sort of the thing that's going to change quite a bit when you start allowing for clonal interference in really large populations that would characterize the Alinsky lines. But for the moment, I think it'll be simple enough to get at many of the key behaviors. Right, so you can model the sort of fitness race between these two things with this effective diffusion model. And so as time goes on, you know, they can acquire more mutations until eventually one of the two clades acquires enough of a fitness difference, so basically a difference in fitness of order X star, that it drives the other one to complete extinction. Right? So this is sort of like the full sweep example showed you on the other slide, except now it's actually mediated by the sort of cumulative effect of many different small mutations. Okay, so this is going to happen on some characteristic timescale, T collapse. And you can predict this relatively simply from this effective diffusion model down here, which I sort of won't get into the details. But the important part is once the ecosystem has collapsed, we're now back to this exact same monomorphic population with a single strategy that we started with. And so it's sort of ripe for re-diversification if the wild-type strain produces a different mutation of effect alpha 2. Yeah.
So I guess the timescale on which this ecology has to be set up must be much faster than the timescale of the collapse.
Exactly. So there will be a second timescale over which this occurs, which I'll call T-diversify. And so in this, again, the strong selection weak mutation context, this will be inversely proportional to the rate of establishment of new lineages. So they'll enter at rate nu, and they'll establish with this invasion fitness, which I calculated on the previous slide before.
Is that what you meant?
Yeah, that's what I meant, because otherwise you wouldn't have this red bubble.
Yeah, I think I know what you mean, and that'll be the next slide.
Okay.
So, yeah. We'll just
because I also...
Yeah,
so
next slide.
When they, yeah, anyway, yeah. We'll be doing the next slide.
Yeah. Okay, so we have these two timescales, and if we think about just sort of the simplest possible ecology, the sort of single locus ecology where you just have these two different strategies you could have, and these strategy mutations just sort of flip you between these two states. at some rate U alpha. That allows you to write down what this invasion fitness is using the formula from the other slide, and then we sort of have everything. And so in this case, it leads to I guess what I'll refer to as a diversification selection balance, which it tells you the relative probability of observing, if you picked a random time, the relative probability of observing the population either in a totally monomorphic ecological state or one where the ecosystem is sort of optimally filled. Right, so the ratio of these two probabilities is just going to be the ratio of the two timescales, and you know you can plug in here to get expressions in terms of the underlying parameters. But the important part here is that you can see sort of matches with intuition that as you increase the number of general fitness mutations, they sort of compete with this ecological pressure to diversify, and can end up sort of due to identity by descent change the structure of the ecosystem from what you would expect. So as you guys have intuited, though, there's sort of a flaw with this little argument that I've shown you here, which is that I haven't actually allowed for any mutations from alpha 1 to turn into alpha 2 before this clade goes extinct, right? So why did I draw these with this big separation here? And in principle, yes, you can have that as well. So you can have situations if the rate of strategy mutations is so low, then of course you will probably go extinct before you end up rediversifying. But as you tune that up a little bit, you can definitely get in situations where if this clade alpha 1 starts becoming more fit than alpha 2, then a mutation from alpha 1 to alpha 2 is going to be more fit than the one that already exists, and so it will establish and take over. And so what you'll see then is sort of what will sort of look like a sweep of this class from the other one, and these blue mutations that are in this big background will sweep through the whole population. But if you just sort of looked at the ecology of these things, you would see just a smooth, steady, optimally utilized ecosystem. And so this sort of thing, as the thing I just flashed by is supposed to tell you, is sort of more along the lines of what people have observed in von Cooper's experiment, for example. Whereas we hardly ever observe stuff like that in Alensky lines, it's sort of more like this case here. Okay, so in general, we can get both of these two different behaviors, and so we now have to consider this sort of niche invasion case as well. And so, if you think about it, as you're accumulating these different fitness mutations, a mutation from one ecological type to the other will have an invasion fitness that's proportional to the fitness differences between the two clades, because it will have exactly the same resource strategy as the one that's already there. It'll differ only in how many general fitness mutations it acquired. And so this leads to a characteristic timescale for invasion, which I'll call T invasion, which is effectively determined by the time that it takes for the expected number of established lineages to be of order 1. Okay, and so again, we can predict the sort of temporal dynamics of this fitness difference between the two clades with this effective diffusion model before, and this allows you to derive relatively simple expressions for the invasion timescale as a function of the parameters. You can see a couple different regimes pop up, which essentially depend on, at what stage of the fitness race does this invasion event actually occur. Okay. So if we can then combine this with the collapse and diversification timescales from the previous slide, this gives us a relatively complete picture of the dynamics of this system in this really simple single locus ecology. Okay. Yeah.
I have a question. So, I mean, there's also some sensitivity to the initial condition because, the collapse of this red thing as a result of the original type getting more mutations relies on this F star being smaller than a half. But you could have a situation where you actually, you invade straight away, in which case you're sort of destined to fix, and then by the same...
Can you say that again?
So, because the larger type always... Yep. Can get more beneficial mutations.
Yep.
There's basically this effective bias that will kill the smaller type, right?
Yep.
Always.
Yep.
But
well, not always, right? Because they can, by chance, accumulate some more mutations and overtake. So there's some noise
there. Yeah, there is. Yeah. But if the initial, so there is, so the way you draw it over here is when this red type arose, basically, this delta, this F star was smaller than a half, and that's why it went extinct. But you could also have a situation where it arises and then it trickles all the way to fix.
So let's think about that a little bit. So the example I've drawn here is one I've sort of tried on purpose to make it roughly 50-50 of the two strains, and that's the point at which you're sort of most uncertain about which one will win, right? And then this expression I wrote down here actually only applies when the both of the two strains are roughly at 50% frequency, or 75-25, and so on, but not when they're 99-1, right? If they're 99-1, then you're exactly right. The one at 99 will sort of deterministically start to take over the population. And that behavior is actually already included in some of these timescales here. So the difference between this one and this one, for instance, well, let me just explain what the three regimes are. So this top regime is when the strategy mutations are really, really fast compared to the general fitness mutations. So you're basically always at sort of stable ecological setup, and you're just waiting for one of the two strains to get a beneficial mutation. And when one of them does, then immediately a strategy mutation will happen which allows it to invade. Right? So that's why it has this particularly simple form. You're just waiting for a fitness mutation. In this next regime, the fitness mutation, many of the fitness mutations can accumulate before the strategy mutation actually arises. And this regime describes what happens when the two things are roughly fluctuating around 50% frequency before one of them actually invades. So when the invasion event happens in this regime, it actually looks a lot like what I've drawn here, where it's something still roughly at 50% and leads to a sweep like that. This third regime here is when one of them has actually gained enough size that it's actually now deterministically favored to win. So there's actually, again, these strong selection weak mutation dynamics. There's like no way the small clade is going to get lucky enough to get enough mutations to swing you back around. And so it starts to undergo what's going to look sort of like a selective sweep. And then the invasion event actually happens when it's at a very large frequency. So you couldn't really even observe it on the time scale here, right? So that's why you get sort of a logarithmic factor here. It talks about deterministic sweep time. This is sort of a power law behavior, which is like, when do you have enough establishment events that you fix?
So do we have to worry in particular, so thinking about these long-term experiments that we're thinking about, right? There is this whole business of diminishing returns, so somehow delta S is decreasing as a function of time.
Yeah.
So we can already imagine this whole picture becoming non-stationary even before it establishes any statistics to use that. But but most of all, is it, I guess what immediately comes to mind, maybe the strategy mutation sort of opens up, if you like, more phase space for your fitness mutation.
Yeah.
And at the moment, it's not in the picture. Not
yes.
that I would necessarily advocate making any picture more complex than
that. Well, I'm actually going to do exactly that now.
Okay.
So that's great intuition, right? So it's a really simple model. Two strategies flipping between. It definitely describes maybe some of these experimental systems, like maybe the yeast evolving to stick on the sides, which we think is just a knockout of an ergosterol pathway, or maybe the wrinkly spreader, which again is sort of a big sort of knockout mutation typically. But in this framing of these consumer resource models, there's sort of no reason why you just have to have these two resource strategies here. That's actually pretty limiting. So now I want to consider the sort of next most complicated case, where we allow the sort of mutation on this other background to actually change the strategy to some intermediate value. We want to think about what happens here. So there's two kinds of intuitions that would guide you here, which lead to sort of two diametrically opposing views. So on the one hand, if you're thinking about these sort of classic models and the absence of fitness differences, I've showed you before, and many people have proved this, that there's sort of marginal colonization resistance once the ecosystem has sort of reached its maximum capacity. So if it's just one strain, there's strong selection pressure for invaders to come in, but once it's actually utilizing the resources optimally, you wouldn't expect new strains to invade with intermediate types. You get this sort of priority effect where the first two things to establish are going to be the ones you typically see.
Wait, is that actually true?
Well, ecologically.
Is it true in your model?
In the absence of fitness differences, yes. Right.
So, as I said before, I would guess that if you have the two strategies, then any mutation in any one of them that is closer to beta can actually replace that resident.
Yeah, can is the key word there. So can, but not favored to. So they're just sort of marginally, invasion fitness is zero, right? So not deleterious, but not beneficial either.
Why would it be zero?
I think I know where you're coming from. Yeah, it's a little bit different than the models that people typically think about in adaptive dynamics, and we can sort of get into the differences there. In the simple two-resource case,
once once the population strategy, so to speak, is paid off,
yep.
all any strain has a invasion fitness zero.
Precisely. Which allows you sort of, you know, in Ned's talk, he explored the consequences of that, and that it allows you to actually get an infinite number of strains coexisting in the population, sort of neutrally. I kind of want to think about it the opposite way. If you start with two, how are you ever going to get so many to drift to high frequency? You basically never will, right? So this is sort of the intuition from the absence of fitness differences. But on the other hand, if you just think about what I was just describing, we just saw that there was really strong selection pressure for invasion from one type to another when you have these fitness differences in the context of this single locus ecology, right? And so these two things can't both be right, so what actually happens? And so it's not too hard, again, in this model to work out what the invasion fitness is, sort of a general strategy mutation, which changes the strategy to some third value, alpha prime. You can plug it in to write down what the invasion fitness is and the limit of small fitness is, and it ends up being proportional to the change in the resource strategy, again, multiplied by the difference in environment-specific mean fitnesses. Right? So and I think this is defined such that the alpha refers to environment one. So if the fitness in environment one is lower than the fitness in environment two, you want to increase your alpha to use more of that environment and vice versa. Okay. But of course, these are defined in terms of the equilibrium frequencies currently in the population. They don't really have any raw meaning on their own or fixed meaning on their own. And so you can show, again, that when both of these niches are filled, you can write down relatively simple expressions for these two environment-specific mean fitnesses, and they behave a little bit like you'd expect, right? So they depend on the fitness difference between the two strains that are currently there, but they also end up depending inversely on the strategy difference between the two strains that are already there. So in general, if you have strains that are very close in strategy, the environment-specific mean fitnesses are going to be really, really magnified and really sensitive to the precise fitness differences between the two strains. But if you're thinking about specialists, then the environment-specific mean fitnesses are essentially always going to refer to the fitness of the strain that's actually in that particular niche. Okay, so you can write down these simple expressions. I think an interesting thing here, going back to a question from earlier, is that you notice these things don't depend at all on beta, right? So where did the environment go in this? And this goes back to what Ned talked about during his talk and what Michael Tikhonov and Pankaj Mehta have been writing about a little bit too, which is that in these filled ecosystems, what these consumer resource models do is they essentially allow the frequencies of the two clades to modify themselves until all the concentrations of the resources are equal. Right, and at that stage, the mean fitnesses are actually reflecting mainly what the relative frequencies of the strains are, and not what you're putting in as an experimenter. And so, I think this has some interesting consequences for fluctuating environments, in that you know you could end up fluctuating the environment a lot here, and it wouldn't actually change the mean fitnesses as experienced by the strains that are currently there. Okay, so again, we can derive these expressions here, plug them in, and get some relatively simple expressions for this invasion fitness. And so you know, you can interpret what this means. I think it's easiest to see in this graphical picture, which I've drawn here. And so the way you interpret this is that, again, we have this sort of resource strategy here on the x-axis from 0 to 1. Now on the y-axis, I've tried to indicate the fitness dimension a little bit. And so x1, this is the fitness of the strain 1, x2 is the fitness of strain 2, and then this line here is the sort of effective mean fitness that a given mutation experiences. And so a strategy mutation is just going to move you along the horizontal axis in this plot. So you're going to keep the same fitness as your ancestor, but change your strategy a little bit. So this is for the resident strain on this side, and this is for the resident strain on the other side with the same shift in resource strategy. And you're going to be favored to invade if your current fitness is above the effective mean fitness that you have to compete with. Right? You're going to be disfavored to invade if your effective fitness is below, if your fitness is below the effective mean fitness. Okay, so you can see here that what happens is you get this region where you're selected against. So if you're the more fit strain, it's actually selected against to sort of move in the direction of resource one. And you can have sort of various intermediate things happening. So to the left here, you're actually favored to invade. And so this is going to push you more, mutations that are favored to invade are the ones that push you more towards the resource strategy when you're the environmental resource supply when you're the more fit strain. So all these are favored to invade, but then you have to figure out what happens when you do invade, right? Again, we have these sort of different possibilities. Do you just sweep out your parents and nobody else? Do you end up sweeping out the entire ecosystem? Or do you hop in and invade a new niche and sweep out them, but leave your parent strain actually around later? Okay, and so you can work out basically all three things happen. If you're on this side of the resource supply, you end up sweeping out your parent and nothing else. If you're on the opposite side, you're effectively in the other niche where the other clade currently is. And in between, there's a sort of a narrow region where these mutations will actually sweep out both clades and take over the population. So this all sort of makes sense from the perspective of most fit strain. Of course, you're going to want to invade lots of these other niches. I think it's a little bit counterintuitive if you think about the less fit strain. So here, actually, you can see that mutations that take you towards the resource supply vector are actually selected against on average. Right? Instead, you actually see there's some positive selection pressure for actually going further away from the environmental... there's some selection pressure for going away from the environmental supply rate. And again, you can work out what happens. Yes, they're selected against. And if you invade here, you end up swooping out your parent. But of course, you can't invade the entire population because you're less fit. So sort of one way of summarizing these sorts of different regimes is that there's some sort of general, that these fitness differences start to create ecological opportunities, sort of as Boris mentioned, for additional tinkering, right? And so in the absence of any fitness differences, you don't really want to change your strategies too much anymore once the ecosystem is filled. But once you start to accumulate differences, there's now going to be positive selection pressure for a lot of further mutations to arise and start to fix. And so maybe you'd expect that there'd be many opportunities for adaptation, which you wouldn't really see unless you considered these strains in their sort of native ecological environment. And the trend here is that you end up getting some selection for the fitter things to sort of become more generalist, at least directionally. Although you can see here, they're definitely allowed to overshoot. And so depending on the sort of exact spectrum of mutations that are available to these things, you can sort of have a steady churn of stably coexisting strains. Or if you allow for infinitesimal things, maybe they'll all wander and sort of match the environmental supply rate, depending on what's available to them. And there's also the selection for these sort of less fit specialists, which I think is a little weird, that you sort of expect there to be strong selection pressure for these sort of less fit strains to actually accumulate different mutations, which make them sort of somehow even worse, but evolution pushes you in that direction. Okay, so I think I will stop there. So far I've just been talking about this really simple two resource case, which I think gives you a lot of intuition, but of course, if the goal here is to understand sort of natural populations, we've also been doing a lot of work on understanding how this scales to much higher dimensions. The math obviously gets a lot more complicated, but the question is whether there's sort of any fundamentally new behavior or sort of new regimes that arise there that you can't actually access just by thinking about this two-species case. So I think I'll just stop there, and if any of you guys want to talk, there's a lot of cool results here, which I'm happy to talk to you about afterwards. But thanks. Questions? Yeah.
So if you go back to the Lenski lines, mm-hmm. Conceptually,
yeah.
And you didn't know about like mutations and metabolism in general and specialist mutations.
Yeah.
So is there a possibility? But in your theory part, you had like two different colors, right? So it was very clear to see. So my question is basically, can you do inference on like being ignorant about whether it's blue or red in the experiment and learn something about what happened?
Yeah.
Maybe that's a naive, but
no, it's a great question. So let me just bring that back. So,
in what minimal information would you
get? Yeah, exactly. So the bad news, I think, is that no, you can't look at this and figure out which one's which often, because when one of them fixes, there's often so many things around that they all fix together in a bunch, right? And so you can tell when something got disrupted. So you're like, oh, probably like something you know, strategy mutation happened here, but like, am I going to be able to see it from the data? Probably not. But I think the good news is, at least in this kind of model, for an experiment, you have a lot more control. And a really good way of testing whether something's a strategy mutation or a general fitness mutation is you can actually isolate that strain and grow it in two different resource supply rates. And that tells you for sure, right? And it's not something we sort of often forget, just sort of looking at the data, but in the context of these experiments, it's a really powerful way of sort of merging these dynamics with this actual differences in growth rates. So, yeah, bad news.
So I guess it's maybe one question or maybe two questions. So you mentioned other people talking about ecological dynamics, and there the big question posed to us all is you know, diversity paradox, and in the context of resource allocation model, how is it that I seem to be more than ant species, etc., etc. And I guess one of the things that was brought up was that, you know, this resource model just takes external resources, but in the microbial community, they make stuff for each other, so when there are new resources produced, the environment is changed. Are you trying to go with this? So I can sort of see that you have sort of a very well-defined problem. There is this Lenski experiment.
Yep.
You know, you analyze it, you have a lot of data, traces like this. You want to understand how to interpret it. Mm-hmm. A very good question. Can we look at these traces and figure out you know, the strategy mutation versus fitness mutation, et cetera, et cetera?
Yep.
If that's what we're doing, what are the two resources or three resources
exactly.
In the middle, minimal media, whatever it is?
In the case of Lenski lines, I mean, I think you raised a really good question. In the case of Lenski lines, if we believe this hypothesis that it's this glucose-acetate cross-feeding thing, the two resources are glucose and acetate. That's a great example because actually in that case, they aren't in the environment. That is a cross-feeding interaction.
Right.
And so although maybe one can kind of understand the sort of key behaviors that arise by thinking about this totally different model where it's supplied by the environment, it actually doesn't sort of microscopically apply to that experiment at all.
Oh, hold on, but right? You presumably could generalize this and make one of the resources produced by
yes.
one of the species,
yes.
And presumably you would find some similar
exactly.
general
exactly.
patterns.
Yes, exactly. And so I think that's sort of, I think sort of there's two directions to sort of go with this, right? So one, which I haven't, you know, since I was just talking about two resources here, I haven't really talked about, which is sort of how does this behavior generalize to lots of resources? So even with two strains, actually, there's no reason to suppose that you just have two resources, right? In fact, it could be many, many more than that, and you just haven't had time to diversify, or selection could have limited you to a level that's below what is theoretically possible, right? So understanding even the two species case in the context of many resources is sort of an open question, but you know, theoretically, I'm actually really interested in trying to understand, you know, how does this kind of process map onto the situation where you have many species and you can measure something like the genealogy, right? So here the genealogy is relatively trivial. It's just like how long has it been since the two clades merged? But when you actually have many species and thinking of the dynamics I talked about now, you have all kinds of weird intermediate things where like some clades are more fit than others and they're favored to invade into other ones. But given that it's more fit, it's actually favored to invade several things, and so you have sort of a very non-neutral kind of genealogical process popping up there. So I'm sort of interested in understanding that. But
what sort of signature would you expect on the level of trees? So in the presence of selection, you know, you're going to get these kind of asymmetric trees.
You get these asymmetric trees, which are very reminiscent of Bolthouse and Stittman. But the really cool feature, I think, is that you actually get trees that have, you know.
So here you'd get more balanced trees because of... you know,
well, they're not balanced, but they're just super deep, right? So you have coalescent events that occur at basically all timescales in this tree, which can vary over several orders of magnitude. And that's something that's very hard to get. Even in a Bolthouse and Stittman model, there's sort of the coalescence rate and the total coalescence rate for the whole population, which goes like log log n or something, so very slowly growing.
But structured in
yeah, but here you end up getting these sort of weird cases where it's not like I drew it here, where it's either everybody descended in a straight line or everybody descended from a star at the bottom. It's somehow in between, and I unfortunately don't really even have good pictures to show you of what that kind of tree looks like, but it's not trivial how to.
So if I understand correctly, you would get these very deep trees if you have two structured populations, so that you're in each of your whatever eco clades, you will be accumulating your X mutations.
Yep.
Whereas if you're continuously invading.
So with two clades, it's simple.
With alpha mutations, then you wouldn't have deep.
Exactly. Yeah.
Sort of,
yeah. So for two things, it's yeah. There's just that one parameter, which is how deep it is. But for many, there's actually an additional structure on top of how deep it is, and that structure ends up being a little fuzzy. So that's sort of the theoretical direction I think these consumer resource models can go. But you're sort of also sort of getting at a deeper question, which is this is just one particular model. It's kind of it's nice that you can do stuff with it, but it doesn't really even describe the simplest experiments that we have to actually test it against. So, in the analogy of sort of the Wright-Fisher model in population genetics, is there some, more general class of models of which this consumer resource is just sort of one specific example, which all these other models sort of go to in the right parameter regimes? And I don't know the answer to that. There's some hints here in some of these limits that there's one in which all the strategies are kind of close to each other, that you get sort of the most general behavior, which is sort of similar to adaptive dynamics kind of models. But yeah, I don't know.
So would you expect the mutation, like the fitness level, to saturate somewhere, or would you?
Yeah. So in this model, there's no fitness saturation. So it's assuming that peak of the general fitness landscape is so far away that you're not even close to getting there. It is interesting in the context of these evolution experiments. There is sort of definite slowdown that you see. And one can think about ways in which you could add that here. It does lead to sort of interesting behavior where it's really easy to establish these sort of ecotypes, and they can fluctuate a lot at the beginning, but over time they actually fluctuate less relative to each other, and maybe that explains why, some weird order one number of Lenski lines ended up being stable the whole time, whereas some other order one number went extinct. Right? That wouldn't make that much sense given the sort of length of times that you see there. But yeah, in the simplest model, it's just directional selection uphill, and how does that change the structure of this system? You can also imagine trying to mimic that kind of directional selection by assuming that there's actually like an infinite number of resources, and what we think are general fitness mutations are just getting rid of resource usage or colonizing these sort of new niches. And so that division is arbitrary to a large extent, and there's sort of interesting ways in trying to see what that actually maps to.
I have a quick question.
Yeah.
Earlier work from Rich with Bruce showed stable coexistence due to biofilm formation of the chemistat.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that's like a really cool aspect of this that we tend to ignore, that we never have a lawless chemistat. So when we're modeling this, you can recreate these trade-offs that Ned discusses
mm-hmm.
on a fitness level. Just mm-hmm. by introducing a new niche, a refuge population will continuously seed in.
Yes. So
what do you think about this? And do you think it's a viable approach?
So I guess that's how I sort of think about a lot of these other systems that aren't actually described by this model, is that you can sort of think about effective resources, like maybe different spatial niches and things like that. The one thing I think this model does have going for it, which I really like, is that you don't actually have to program the niches in ahead of time. Right, so you start with these different resources, and I've showed you that in this two resource case, there is sort of a way in which you can think about these things really as being different niches, right, on either side of this resource vector. But actually, that intuition totally breaks down as soon as you even move to three resources. Like, now the niches aren't sort of independently existing on their own. It really depends who else is in there with you. And so I sort of like that aspect of these models, that you have stable behavior without programming in a niche, and you can therefore sort of change things over time. But yeah, in general, there's got to be sort of a mixture of these two things going on. And
what happens when you, I mean, this is an n-dimensional problem.
Yeah.
Do you foresee this being developed within the next 10 years?
That is, understand the behavior for a large number of resources? Yes. Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, some things we've actually already figured out already. The problem really with many, many resources is not so much the math, but the parameters, right? So even in this two resource case, I kind of slipped by it, but we actually have no idea what any of these mutation rates and fitness effects and resources and stuff are. And that gets even worse for many resources. And so you can write down these kind of simple models, but I think we really have to think about ways in which we can try to parameterize that space to really know in which regime of these n-dimensional systems we're actually in order to interpret the data. And so, yeah, I'll talk a little bit about on Monday about some like very, very, very first steps to try to do that in the context of the microbiome, but it's, you know, at such a the beginning stage at this point that you actually probably won't even recognize the connection between these two things. So, there's a long way to go. All right. Well, thank you, guys.